You're listening to The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The year is 1922. 3 million people call Illinois home. The Lincoln Memorial is about to be dedicated in Washington. And down the street, President Warren Harding has installed a cutting-edge communications device in the White House. Electromagnetic radiation allows the human voice to travel thousands of miles from an antenna to a device called a radio. Vincent Lopez and his orchestra, whom we're hearing now, were early stars of this young medium. And right here in the 21st state, on the night of April 6th, 1922, the University of Illinois brought a new radio station to life. Months before the creation of the BBC and decades before NPR, our show's home station, WILL-AM, had its inaugural broadcast. So we're going to take some time in today's show to acknowledge the anniversary of what's now known as Illinois Public Media. Later, we'll talk with two of our station's notable alumni, including former 21st Show host Nyla Boodoo and Jeremy Hobson, who started making radio here and went on to host Here and Now. But first, we're joined by my Illinois Public Media colleague, Jim Meadows, who spent months digging into our archives. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, glad to be here, Brian. And yeah, I've been geeking out on this stuff since about September.
Fantastic. Listeners, if you have memories of WILL you want to share, join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. So Jim, that first broadcast, less than an hour long, what was said?
Well, first, we should note there are no recordings of that first broadcast, virtually very few recordings of any radio from the 1920s. But according to the University of Illinois student newspaper, the Daily Illini, the broadcast opened with the dean of the university, Thomas Arco Clark, giving a talk called Why College Students Fail. And there were other short talks by faculty turning cream into gold about dairy science, the value of parks for towns of Illinois. There was news about U of I sports, the baseball and track teams. There was a progress report on the new Memorial Stadium they were getting ready to build. And there were some jokes. They told some jokes. I don't know what the jokes were, but the Daily Illini noted that. And Joseph Wright, the university publicity director, WILL's first director of broadcasting, asked listeners to write in about how they heard the station, their reception, and what programs they would like to hear in the future. And that was it. 15 minutes on, 15-minute break, another 15 minutes on, and they came back next week and did it again. They had music on for the first time in their second broadcast.
Wow. Turning dairy into gold. Some things never change on public radio, do they? All right. So at this time, this is according to an April 15th, 1922 issue of Radio Digest Illustrated, there are about 15 stations in Illinois. Today, there's well more than 500 in our state. So what was it that made the U of I and other universities decide to get into the radio business?
Well, for universities, and there were other universities, some of them don't have stations anymore or are stopped for a while before they did. But I would say about this same time, Purdue University started WBAA over in Indiana, and folks here would have heard that. They would have heard WOI over in Ames, Iowa. And universities got into it because of the science. Like the internet in the 1990s, that was radio in the early 1920s. It was the big new communications technology. It was a technical challenge. And the Department of Electrical Engineering at the U of I was involved in making this work. But colleges and universities were also, they also wanted to promote their institution. And they were starting to build the concept of bringing their services to people that they couldn't reach otherwise. In preparing the stories I've been doing on WYLL Centennial, I talked with University of Michigan media historian Susan Douglas, and she says there were others in academia who envisioned using radio as a new way to educate the country.
You know, radio was accompanied by a host of utopian predictions about educating people, about uplifting the illiterate, about radio becoming a giant university, you know, in the sky, where people could hear lectures that they could never hear in person because they were too far away or they didn't have the money to go to school.
So today WILL has this huge signal. For those of us who are listening, you might be hearing us on a clear day, at least. Today's not so clear, but on a clear day, you could hear us as far north as Chicago, as far east as Indianapolis. Was it always that way?
Well, actually, when we started, the coverage was even bigger, and that was the expectation in the early days of radio, because AM radio signals bounced off the ionosphere, and they bounce off the ionosphere even better at night. Signals can travel for hundreds of miles. So our first broadcasts as WRM in the 1920s were at night, and we would get letters from listeners. The practice was known as DXing back then. You search the radio dial for stations, and then you write in to tell them that you heard them. So we knew that we were getting being listened to through much of the Midwest. The call letters, I think we heard this at the beginning of the program, where Joseph Wright noted that WRM stands for We Reach Millions.
Not the worm.
That too, but for some people. But the thing that happened is that the 1920s went on. The radio dial became very overcrowded with news stations. The federal government tried to reduce the interference that resulted by starting to reassign radio stations the new frequencies, new power limits. And in that reshuffling, non-commercial stations like WILL did not fare well. WILL was bounced around with different frequencies, with power restrictions, with at times having to share a frequency with other stations, so they had to timeshare. When it all shook out in the mid-1930s, WILL was at its current frequency. It had it eventually got 5,000 watts, which is a regional power level. It can reach a lot of the state during the day, but it had to power down at night.
All right, so talk a little bit, or let me just take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We're talking about the 100th anniversary of the station that brings you this program, WILL AM, which, as we said, just when it went on the air, it was at the call letters WRM, and it signed on at the University of Illinois 100 years ago tonight. We want to hear your memories of the station, even if you weren't tuned in on that unseasonably warm day in 1922. Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're talking with my Illinois Public Media colleague, Jim Meadows, who's spending the year documenting WILL's roots. So let's move ahead to some of the notable broadcasts that you've uncovered and recordings you've found in the archives. There are literally thousands of hours of audio, including, like, for example, famous poets Carl Sandburg, T.S. Eliot, and Langston Hughes.
Langston Hughes, this is a recording that we found within within the collection of transcription discs that the station made. This was from an appearance that Langston Hughes made at the university in 1957. He spoke at the auditorium at Gregory Hall, and at the time, WILL was wired in to a lot of spots, lecture halls, concert spaces around the university, so that they could record these fairly easily. Originally recorded on a 16-inch phonograph disc designed for radio transcription use. It's like a vinyl record, but bigger. These discs, just by their nature, so they could etch a recording into the surface, they wore out more quickly than regular records. So you're going to hear some pops and hisses here. But this is Langston Hughes reading his poem, Merry-Go-Round.
Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister? Because I want to ride. Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's a horse for a kid that's black? Oh.
Okay, that is fantastic. I love that clip. Let's go to the phones now. 800-222-9455. Steve is calling in from Chicago. Steve, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very enjoyable. My only comment was I remember two shows. We used to live in Vermilion County when our kids were small. We're back up in Chicago. And there were two shows. One was called Focus 580. And then the afternoon, I believe it was called the Afternoon magazine, and I believe the young lady's name was Celeste Quinn. I'm probably getting it wrong.
But, no, you're right about that. Celeste Quinn, that's right.
Yeah, and I believe she was married to the host of Focus 580, whose name I escapes me. I apologize, but
David Inge.
Anyway,
David Inge. Yes.
I'm sorry.
David Inge.
Yep.
Yeah, and, I too got started. That my first experience is listening to public radio myself, or as a student at the U of I, listening to Focus 580. That show had great guests coming through town. Punched above its weight.
Yeah, no, it was great. At the time, I was a traveling salesman, and all through Central Illinois, and it was a great companion. He had very interesting guests on, authors and such, and often I would call in and just add my, two cents or comment or something like that. But it was very, very enjoyable. I don't know if you guys can speak to. It just seems back in the day it was less. It was more independent, more local programming on WILL. Now it seems to be coming out of Washington or New York more often. I could be wrong, but
sure,
I would be interested in your comments on that. And thank you for taking my call.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for calling in. And Jim, that actually raises a good point because, yeah, I think a lot of NPR, a lot of that is more centralized. We, the 21st show, right, I think there's a way of looking at us as coming out of Focus 580. That's definitely one of our predecessor talk shows. But now we're on statewide, so we do try to focus on issues that matter to all of Illinois. But this station, WILL, it did play a role in the development of the national public radio system. Can you talk about that?
That's right. And first of all, we had those talk shows, Focus 580 and the Afternoon Magazine, because at the time when those shows began in the 1970s and 80s, there were no national daily programs available between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I don't know if there was a concept that there should be, but I know that in this case, Don Mullally, who's for whom those programs were, he was the one who essentially created them and got them rolling. It was the idea that he wanted a program that could do what those shows did, bring in a wide variety of guests and make them accessible to the audience, because these were really call-in shows where calls from listeners were front and center.
All right. One other aspect of WILL I think we have to talk about is agriculture and the importance. I mean, it's a major part of the Illinois economy. How is that reflected in WILL's mission and broadcasts over the years?
Well, I think that's interesting because it's not what people think of when they think of public radio now, but it has been a part of WILL's programming from early on, right in the middle of a largely rural downstate area. And at a school with a big college of agriculture and an extension service for reaching those rural areas, we've had agriculture-based programming for a long time. It started with programming aimed at farmers and also aimed at farm families with the early homemaker shows that we ran up into the 1970s. These days, the programs are more based on the commodity markets, not just market updates, which used to be a big part of what we did because farmers didn't have many avenues, say 30 or 40 years ago, to get those numbers during the day, but also these days analysis of those markets, and they continue to reach an audience, and sometimes I think continue to mystify the more urban listeners for whom this is not part of their lives, but it's I think a really important service.
And a tradition that goes back. I mean, people talk about broadband access today and a lack of broadband access in rural areas, but particularly back then, you really had that going on. All right, so we only have a couple of minutes left in our conversation. As I've mentioned, you've spent going on, it'll be a year or soon, researching WILL's history, creating historical minutes of radio and feature stories. What has really impressed or jumped out at you in your research over these past several months?
I'm really struck by just how much the folks at WYLL and the other early, what were then called educational stations around the country, were doing everything for the first time and figuring out what they wanted to do, their vision to create an educational service that would fill a gap that the largely commercial and entertainment system of broadcasting in the United States was not doing. WYLL played a role in helping to organize broadcasters into the first national organizations. Later in our history, our director of broadcasting, Don Mullally, would become the chairman of the board of NPR and essentially rescue it from the brink of financial collapse in the 1980s when it was up against a crisis. Those were two areas which played a big role in the national picture of public broadcasting that we have today.
And he was a pivotal character in that. You know, people talk about, I think in commercial media, when people who work in it, they say the network, they're talking about CBS or ABC, the big headquarters in New York City or Washington. When people talk about the network in public radio, it's really the stations that is what really makes public radio, and that's what's so unique. Any closing thoughts on that in about 30 seconds?
I think that is the case. You know, WYLL in the 1950s was the home base of the first national program syndication service for educational radio. The reorganization of NPR in the 1980s was a system which essentially, instead of sending federal tax revenue to NPR, it sent it to the stations, who then made the decisions on what they wanted from NPR, what they were ready to pay for.
Well, Jim Meadows, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for all the work you've been doing this year. I really enjoy listening to your pieces on our history and just the history of Illinois in general. Listeners, if you want to hear some of what Jim has been working on, you can go right now to 21stshow.org to see links to some of his stories. Jim, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be here.
And coming up, two national public radio voices associated with Illinois public media in the past, Nyla Boodoo, Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to The 21st Show. Stay with us.